This weekend starts right after this.
When shopping for car insurance, consider this. GEICO has been saving people money on car insurance for over 75 years. So if you're serious about savings, it's simple. Go to GEICO.com. After 75 years, they know how to save you money.
From Compass Media Networks, this is America's First News. This weekend, with your host, Gordon Deal.
Beer for brunch. I'm Gordon Deal, along with Jennifer Koschenka. First weekend in July. Welcome aboard. Here's what's coming up this hour.
A study finds that one in five Americans who drinks alcohol at brunch chooses beer. Hear how craft breweries are responding.
A tongue-in-cheek proposal on how to deal with obnoxious sports parents
that can't miss events for the 4th of July weekend.
And who pays on the first date? Because with more people on first dates than ever, thanks to apps, going out can get expensive quickly.
I did some calculations in this story, and in New York or San Francisco, paying for two people three times a week can amount to more than $20,000 annually. So it can add up.
Wall Street Journal reporter Khadija Safdar tries to settle the dispute later in the hour. Well, the healthcare vote will be a key moment for senators to decide what role the institution will play in decision-making in Washington going forward. Patricia Murphy, columnist at Roll Call, says the Senate has lost its way. Patricia, how do you see this?
So in watching the way that the healthcare debate has gone down, and I use the word debate very carefully here, the Senate has really played such a small role this time around compared to the role that they played with the original Obamacare debate. They've been pretty much cut out of the process by the House, and this legislation has been shipped over to the Senate. It had a little bit of tweaking, but the product was mostly what the House had already prepared for the Senate. And it's just such a different way for the Senate to be operating. I feel like it has made kind of a worse bill. It's produced a bill that a lot of senators just cannot even begin to consider because they don't have information about it. They didn't have any input to it. So I feel like it's unfair to ask the Senate to vote for this bill. And senators are people who legislate. This is their jobs, and they should be demanding a chance to be the Senate again. And so that's what this piece is about.
Now, I thought it was interesting because in one line in your story, you sort of said the Senate has given away power over, a couple of years. What do you mean by that?
Well, so I think under Republican leadership and Democratic leadership, we have seen the Senate start to become, I think, a lot of times when there are tough votes that they could and should be taking, if there's an election looming, a midterm election, a presidential election, it really doesn't matter. The Senate has avoided tough votes, so they have not debated military action in a lot of cases when an older previous Senate would have debated some of the military action that President Obama and President Trump have been taking. They sort of avoid hard votes because they don't want to put their members on the record that could be kind of sliced and diced into a 30-second ad if they're up for re-election. And so the Senate has started to really, in my opinion, cower in the face of a lot of tough decisions. They don't really pass a budget anymore. They rarely pass appropriations bills anymore. They kind of don't do anything anymore. And so they'll name a post office. They'll do an omnibus that nobody knows anything about. But they don't do the hard work anymore. And these are people who have really upended their lives to be a part of the Senate. I think a majority of senators want to be doing what they're supposed to be doing.
We're speaking with Patricia Murphy, columnist at Roll Call. She's written a piece entitled "Let the Senate Be the Senate Again." The cynic in me says, like members of the House, they're just interested in their own reelection and not necessarily doing the dirty work. But that may have always been the case. How do you read that?
Well, I think that the Senate leadership now takes takes a lot more power away from the committee chairs. And so these decisions are made by the Senate majority leaders. They're not made by, the chairman of the Appropriations Committee, the chairman of the Senate Finance Committee that should be debating this health care bill. And so the Senate leaders, and I know this from covering the Senate, pull bills that they don't want their members to have to vote on. We saw it happen this week. They don't want their members to be exposed to a politically controversial bill. And I think that's a trend we've seen in the last certainly 6 years under Senator Reid and Senator McConnell. Mm-hmm. So it's something that I know is happening in the Senate. It of course happens a lot in the House, but the more the Senate leaders are making the decisions instead of the senators, I think we've seen the Senate ironically and unintentionally pull their own power back and let the presidents make the hard decisions.
But how did we arrive here, this sort of spineless approach, if you will?
Well, I think it's been a process that's been building a lot for years. I think the campaign finance has probably played a significant role. These elections are getting more and more expensive.
Yeah.
They're requiring a lot more time for senators, and senators are just simply more focused now on their own reelections. It's become, I think, more partisan, it's half their job is keeping their job. But to talk to individual senators, they're frustrated with that process. They don't like it. They are away from their families for long periods of time. They've spent their entire careers building to this moment. And to talk to individual senators, they want to legislate. They want to vote. They want to be rolling up their sleeves. But the leaders tend to want to keep their power. And so they make, I think, short-term decisions to get through the next election. As a result, they're not making long-term decisions for the country.
Thanks, Patricia. Patricia Murphy, columnist at Roll Call. 12 minutes now after the hour on this weekend. Glad you could be with us. Opening up the month of July, there's a big problem with youth sports today. It's not the equipment or the fields or the courts or other services, nor the money, nor the enthusiasm, nor video games. The biggest problem today, meddling parents. But Wall Street Journal sports writer Jason Gay has a solution, even if a bit tongue-in-cheek. I know coaches and refs would be in support of this. Jason, set this up.
Well, I experienced it from the bluntest end possible, which is as a former Little League umpire and referee in basketball. And I remember full well the agitated parents and sometimes the spittle of agitated parents. Mm. But what really drew me into this, Gordon, was there was a piece in the Washington Post a couple days ago where they talked about in the D.C. region that refereeing umpires have dropped dramatically in that area because of parents. Like, umpires are just fed up. They're not going to do it anymore. Not really a high glamour, high pay job. And if they're going to get screamed at all day by folks, what's the point of it? So there actually is a crisis now in youth sports in some places because they just can't get people to officiate the games because the parents are so bad.
It's unbelievable. Anybody take a guess as to where this bad behavior came from people who are otherwise, as you say, kind of law-abiding citizens?
Well, there's a couple of interesting theories. I mean, of course, the first is just the vicarious parent, right? The parent who, is trying to live a sports life that they never themselves were able to achieve and live it through a child. The second thought is just, the general cultural coarsening that's gone on. We're not very civil to each other on airplanes and in politics and in public life. How are we expected to be civil to each other in front of a baseball diamond? And then the last thing, very interestingly, some referees have come forward to send me some notes about this, that they think instant replay culture has contributed to this a little bit.
Wow.
Because we're so accustomed now to, striving for perfection, 100% accuracy within officiating in sports, that just the notion of some sort of imperfection is getting lost and that you don't get it right all the time, and that's okay too. That's what life is all about. That's just unacceptable. In fact, I spoke to somebody just recently who mentioned that they've seen parents walk up with phones and say, "Look, I caught this on my phone. You should replay this. This is a youth soccer game." Jeez. I mean, that's how cockamamie it's gotten, Gordon.
Oh, my goodness. We're speaking with Wall Street Journal sports writer Jason Gay. He's written a piece called "Let's Put Bad Sports Parents in a Box." Oh, sir. So to your headline, you got this interesting idea, a little penalty box of sorts for bad behaving parents on the sidelines.
Yes. I mean, if we're not able to incarcerate them, which is my first recommendation, I think some sort of prefab plexiglass, little air holes at the top, soundproof cage on the side of Little League diamonds and basketball courts and soccer fields, I think that would really do wonders in terms of patrolling the noise level at youth sports. In fact, Gordon, I think that there'd be parents who would volunteer there are parents who love to yell so much at these games, they would probably volunteer to go into that box just so they could just do it without fear of any sort of reprisal. I'm half kidding here, but I was struck immediately by how many people responded to this call, how many parents who are out there every weekend, several weeknights, going to games, and how turned off they are by the behavior of fellow parents. And it really is. You know, I hate to use the word epidemic. We're so full of hype in sports, but it does feel like some kind of crisis because, you know, all the things, I mean, think about it, Gordon, all the things that we remember about sports are about teammates and what we learned and camaraderie and the experience of that. Like, none of us can remember who won or lost.
Yeah,
99% of the games in which we play.
You know, that behavior, too, is not just restricted to the sidelines. I remember taking a soccer coaching course one time,
yeah,
and the instructor said, kids don't sign up to play soccer to win championships. They sign up to make friends, get exercise,
yeah,
and stay busy. And the worst part of soccer for children often is the ride home.
Yeah.
When parents say, what happened today? Why didn't you do this? Why didn't you do that?
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's just not just on the sidelines either. This psychobabble is everywhere.
You know, my father was a high school coach for 40 years. And when he would come to my games, he would bring his lawn chair and he would sit there with a newspaper and a book and he would read the whole time and he barely looked up from it. And he never made any noise. And I used to think, what's the matter with this guy? He's like not even paying attention to the game. And I realize now that, like, that was exactly the right level,
yeah,
of attention paid to youth sports. You know, he was there just in case something traumatic happened.
Right.
But, you know, he was not going to live on every pitch.
And as I say to parents sometimes, are you this involved with your child's schoolwork? Is this what you do during the day from 9 to 3?
No, of course not. Of course not. And you certainly don't go into algebra class and say, like, you know what? I think little Timmy needs a little bit more time, you know, playing time in algebra. You know, if you know what I mean, you should be calling on him some more.
Thanks, Jason. Wall Street Journal sports writer Jason Gay. 22 minutes now after the hour on this weekend. Are you in the group? Around 6 in 10 Americans are likely to drink alcohol with their weekend brunch, and at least one study finds 21% drink beer at brunch. Restaurants are finding that beer on morning cocktail menus appeals to diners who crave new flavor pairings or a lower-octane alcoholic beverage early in the day compared with traditional vodka or champagne-based drinks. Here's this weekend's Jennifer Koschenka.
When you think of what pairs with beer, you might think burgers or wings, probably not pancakes. But there's a new trend afoot as brewers try to break into the brunch game. Ellen Byron of the Wall Street Journal has written a story about this new eye-opener and joins us now. Ellen, what brewers are behind this move and why?
Well, there's a lot of brewers. I mean, starting with the biggest one, Anheuser-Busch, but also a lot of craft breweries are looking at brunch and realizing that it's become a big drinking occasion.
Are they doing this partly because sales are not going so well for a lot of beers?
Yeah, volumes are down not only in the U.S. but also globally. So that is happening. So they're looking across the board at how do we find new business opportunities, either bring new people to beer or find new occasions where current beer drinkers could drink more beer. And they've realized that brunch is a good opportunity. More people are eating brunch, going out to restaurants for brunch than they used to, and they sit and linger and like to sip alcohol as part of that meal. And right now, primarily, it's those Bloody Marys or mimosas that top most brunch menus, but a lot of beer companies, especially those that make a lot of flavored beers, are wondering, why can't we have a seat at the table as well?
Ellen, what are some of those new beer flavors that are trying to pair with brunch?
Well, Goose Island has a beautifully bottled beer called Sophie, and that has orange notes, white pepper notes, and a lot of bubbles. And they're saying that belongs at the brunch table, and it pairs very well with a wide variety of breakfast foods. Then there's other beers, including Harpoon Brewery. I spoke with them just last weekend. They hosted a brunch at their brewery in Boston, highlighting their Huckleberry UFO beer. and over 100 people bought tickets to this brunch and ate huckleberry donuts and a lot of other brunch foods, including eggs, and sipped huckleberry beer.
I still can't really wrap my head around beer going with waffles or pancakes. Do some of the beers pair with sweeter foods?
Yes, and that was one of the first questions that went through my mind as I started having these conversations with brewers. How on earth do you pair maple syrup with beer? But they said actually the flavors go very well together, and there are beers, including some breakfast stouts and a beer by Dogfish Head called Beer for Breakfast that already have maple syrup in the beer itself. Other beers, they say, do have trouble pairing with especially sweet brunch food. And I talked to consumers as well who said, I'm not ready to make that leap. However, when you try some of the shandies and some of the fruit-flavored beers, you realize that they are leaning much more in the sweet realm and that it would work fine with some of these sweeter brunch foods.
That is this weekend's Jennifer Koshenka with Wall Street Journal reporter Ellen Byron. I don't think I've had beer at brunch, but the grapefruit-flavored beers, like the Shandy she mentioned, I think would go. I was certainly willing to try. 30 minutes after the hour on This Weekend. Small business never stops moving, so Dell's U.S.-based small business technology advisors are trained to keep up. Just call 877-BUY-DELL to get connected with an advisor who will get to know your business and tailor a solution with Dell PCs powered by Intel Core processors that is right for you, so you can focus on your business and leave the tech questions to Dell. Call 877-BUY-DELL to get in touch with a tech advisor today.
America's First News is online all the time. Follow us on Twitter at This Morning Show, like us on Facebook, or send us an email, thismorning@compassmedianetworks.com.
Glad you could be with us on this first weekend of July. Gordon Deal with Jennifer Koshenka. Coming up this half hour, the can't-miss events for the 4th of July weekend. Also, the debate gaining more steam these days. Who pays on the first date? Thanks to new dating apps, no one really knows anymore. And the California kid who's placing thousands of flags on veterans' headstones. We'll have that story in about 20 minutes. Well, there are nearly 7.5 million Americans living with psoriasis, a chronic inflammatory disease of the immune system. And up to 30% of those people with psoriasis may eventually develop psoriatic arthritis, a potentially debilitating disease involving joint inflammation that affects an estimated 1 million people in the U.S. The many faces of psoriatic disease include Olympic swimming champ Dara Torres, one of the fastest female swimmers in history, who's also an author. She's promoting, by the way, a campaign called Show More of You. Dara, what exactly is it, first off, and how has it affected you?
Well, psoriatic disease has two little categories under it. There's psoriasis and psoriatic arthritis, and I suffer from the skin disease psoriasis. And I first noticed it back in the early 90s when I was training for the 92 Olympic team. I had these red flaky patches on my elbows, and I didn't really know what it was. I thought maybe the chlorine level was too high or the fact that maybe there was another, you know, chemical in the pool that was irritating my skin. So I let it go for a couple months, but then I realized, well, no one else is getting this, and it didn't go away. So I went to my dermatologist, and that's when I was first diagnosed with psoriasis. So I'm very honored to be teaming up with Celgene and Otezla for this Show More of You campaign.
All right. So at that point, what did you learn? That you were going to have this to deal with for the rest of your life, or that there was some treatment available?
Well, they gave me some topical ointment just to put on it and just live with it. And I realized as the years went on that mine was more stress-related, so I don't have it 24/7, but I get it when I'm very stressed. And for me, anything to relieve stress really helps keep this in control, my psoriasis. But, you know, it's been a lot of fun, this with this campaign, the Show More of You campaign. We did a wonderful photo shoot with famed photographer Martin Scholler with four other people, and it was just a really a fun day, and we were able to take lots of pictures, but also sort of connect and relate our stories to each other. And if you go to the showmoreofyou.com website, you can see our photos from that photo shoot. And we really encourage people who are suffering from this disease to upload their photos, share their stories, and people who aren't suffering to go on showmoreofyou.com to learn more about what psoriasis is.
Let me ask you this, too, because as somebody who performs and at times worked in a bathing suit, was it extra difficult not only from a comfort standpoint, but just from a visibility standpoint?
That is a great question, because if you think about it, my business suit is my swimsuit, so it's like a free-for-all. You can see everything, and I was very embarrassed, and that's one of the things that I'm honored about this campaign to be a part of, is the fact that I can share my story, and I think anyone can relate to me having been in a swimsuit, you know, 24/7 almost for God knows how many years, and I can tell you how old I am now. But I want people to understand that I've been through this. Don't be embarrassed. Be comfortable in your own skin, and don't let this get in the way of following your dreams.
Did it ever shut you down physically?
No, it didn't. Mine was strictly on my skin, and it didn't shut me down physically, but it can be very irritable, always scratching your skin.
Yeah. We're speaking with Olympic swimming great Dara Torres, talking about psoriatic disease. She's part of a campaign called Show More of You. What are you doing these days, by the way? How do you stay fit?
I love to box, and I love to do bar methods. So I try to do anything that relieves stress so my psoriasis doesn't flare up.
That's interesting. So do you still today try to identify stress triggers and say that that's going to be a problem for me? Let me go through my five steps routine or something like that?
100%, because I notice it start to flare up when I do get stressed, and the best thing for me to do is de-stress and decompress, and that way I realize that it doesn't flare up as often as if I'm more aware of it.
Do you have is it psychological and physical stress, or just psychological?
I think just both. You know, I have an 11-year-old running around. That's stress enough as it is.
Yep.
And a couple stepkids, and so, you know, and work. There's a lot of reasons why you can get stressed out in today's world, and you know, I just try to keep it as low level stress as I possibly can.
I didn't think about the physical part. When is it possible that when you're burning, who knows, 10,000 calories in a day during a workout, that it could have been physical stress at times?
Well, I make sure I eat lots and lots of calories, so I don't have to worry about that.
Olympic swimmer Dara Torres. Again, the campaign is called Show More of You. 21 minutes now in front of the hour on This Weekend. You don't often find the words business and friendly in the same sentence, let alone the same state. Unless, of course, you're talking about Michigan. Michigan's business-friendly practices help them become a leader in industries that range from agriculture and cybersecurity to aerospace and defense. In fact, Michigan is ranked among the top 10 states for major new and expanded facilities, which makes Michigan more than business-friendly. It makes Michigan business smart. To learn more, visit MichiganBusiness.org. While Independence Day may land on a Tuesday this year, that doesn't mean millions of Americans aren't starting their celebrations a few days early. The July 4th weekend is one of the biggest of the summer when it comes to events, from music, sports, and of course, fireworks. Here's what's cooking from Janine Tornatore, senior editor at VividSeats.com. Janine, seems our thirst for travel has grown.
Well, according to AAA, it's going to be a big one for travelers. Over 44 million people are planning to travel to celebrate Independence Day weekend. That's up by over a million travelers compared to last year. And what do people travel for this weekend? To experience the weekend. And it's really all about these experiences, whether it's huge fireworks displays, sitting at a baseball game, or taking in an Independence Day concert. And we've got the scoop on what are the top-selling events over this holiday weekend.
Very good. All right, so what draws the crowds? What makes the news here?
Well, according to Vivid Seats, the top sellers run the gamut. We've got our number one selling summer festival is in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. It's Summerfest, probably more well-known in the Midwest, but this is a major week-long event that covers over July 4th weekend with big headliners. We've also had down in Daytona, the International Speedway down there, hosts the Coke Zero 400 over the weekend, a huge event for NASCAR fans and a big seller. We've got major fireworks displays, of course, all over the country, from New York to Philadelphia to Boston. And it's a big weekend for baseball. Some of the top-selling games this weekend, the Toronto Blue Jays at Yankee Stadium, the Arizona Diamondbacks at the Dodgers, including fireworks after the July 4th game there, and even the Minnesota Twins at the Kansas City Royals is a big seller.
Wow. All right, so how do we kind of keep one hand on the wallet
you know, here without breaking the bank.
Sure. Well, even after you maybe purchase tickets to some of these events, you can still get hit with a lot of costs that people don't expect and don't find out about until they actually arrive at the event. The first big one can be parking, and people don't really think about this until they arrive and they see it's going to be $50 to park at one of these major venues. So you want to really, you know, weigh your options. It can be a lot cheaper these days to use one of the ride-sharing services than it is to go and park, and a lot more convenient as well. It's also a lot about what you bring. You know, it sounds like a small thing, but even bringing your own bottle for water and filling up as you go throughout the day can save you a lot of money. You know, a family of four or five buying $5 bottle of water all day long can really add up at some of these hot outdoor venues. And also about what not to bring. You don't want to bring your expensive jewelry or wear your designer sunglasses, anything that you might be devastated to lose at these events. And make sure that you're bringing cash. That sounds kind of counterintuitive to carry around cash at one of these events, but ATMs can be scarce and they certainly will have hefty fees. So keep that in mind, as well as with your smartphone, bringing one of those portable chargers. They're cheap and they're easy to stash away, and with everybody live streaming and Instagramming their way through these events, you can be left without power by the end of the event.
Right. Good call. We're speaking with Janine Tornator, senior editor at VividSeats.com. We're talking about the can't-miss events for the 4th of July weekend. What about buying merchandise? I know that was one of the notes here.
Yeah, so a lot of people, you know, they want to get into the show or whatever it is they're there to see, and they all just do that afterwards. Well, a lot of times you'll find that the, you know, favorites at the merchandise tables are sold out or they don't have your size at the end. So it's best when you first get there, if you see something that catches your eye, to purchase it early on before things sell out.
What about the guy who, you know, is the, like, street entrepreneur? He shows up with his own pack of, like, 100 concert t-shirts. Even though the word is spelled wrong, you know, the event, you do save $20 on the t-shirt.
You do. And actually, for, you know, those guys that may not be the official seller, sometimes if you do wait until after the event, you might be able to haggle your way down a few dollars if they're trying to offload a lot of things at the end, especially if something might be a little bit off about it. But generally speaking, getting it early on is your best bet.
And to your point about cash, right, it's easier to haggle if you've got some cash.
It's easier to haggle if you've got cash, and a lot of these folks, they may only take cash, especially at these tables where they're trying to move people along rather quickly.
Thanks, Janine. Janine Tornator, senior editor at VividSeats.com. 13 minutes now in front of the hour on this weekend. Coming up next, who pays on the first date these days? Thanks for being with us. Love in the time of dating apps like Tinder is upending an age-old tradition between men and women. That moment when the bill arrives and the woman makes a fake reach for her wallet, but expects the guy will insist on paying. In a time when first dates are more common than ever and therefore can be more costly, the issue of pay has a new twist. Here's Wall Street Journal reporter Khadija Safdar. Khadija, what did you find?
So what I found, first I just want to apologize really quickly for my voice. I lost it. I don't normally sound like this. But so what I found while I was interacting and just collecting all these anecdotes was that people have very different expectations for what they expect on a date, especially when it comes down to pay the check. And I think when those different expectations collide, it just presents for some really awkward scenarios that as I piece them together, it was a bit funny. When you kind of read them together, they have like one person who says that he's fighting gender stereotypes by letting a woman pay, and on the other end of the spectrum, they're kind of viewing that as rude. So it was a fun piece to report.
Have we always been this conflicted, or is this sort of a new thing?
I think it's probably exacerbated by the availability of dates nowadays, because we have all these like online dating apps like Tinder, OkCupid, and so it's just much easier to go on a lot of dates. And so I think there's like just some expense or money element to this. I'm not sure if people can afford all the dates that they're going on. I did some calculations in this story, and in New York or San Francisco, paying for two people three times a week can amount to more than $20,000 annually. So it can add up.
Wow. It almost needs to be a segment within the dating app, like, you know, press here or swipe here if you believe the check should be split evenly on a date.
I know. I think that it would make it a lot easier if people stated their expectations out front, so there wasn't any awkwardness later on.
Jeez, I don't know if I'm old school or not, but I sort of feel if I initiated the date, it's on me to pay for it, but I can see if you're doing that 3 times a week, boy, that would add up quickly. What's the solution these days?
So I think I interviewed also an etiquette expert, and she agreed with you there. She said that if you initiate, you're the one who's supposed to pay. But I think just like expectations have changed, and there's also this thing that I noticed as I was interviewing people, that a lot of times women will do this reach for their wallet, and they usually expect that it will be declined.
Yeah.
So it's kind of a disingenuous reach. And on the other end, I think sometimes the other person or the man on the other side might assume that they really mean it. They want to split it in half. So they're just, it's just, I think at some point, miscommunication.
Right, right. Oh, man. So I got to ask you then, have you ever done the fake reach?
No, I usually end up splitting it. And I it's funny because when I was reporting out the story, I didn't realize that it was meant to be disingenuous. So it's kind of funny, but I've never really been on a date where I felt that, well, I'm married and I have been, so I'm probably not the best candidate to ask about this, my personal experience, but I've never been on a date where I felt like somebody was trying to offload the check on me.
Okay.
So it's kind of interesting. I think maybe this is a more new phenomenon.
What also might matter is where the server places the check when he or she comes to the table. Wall Street Journal reporter Khadija Safdar, 5 minutes now in front of the hour. A 12-year-old boy in California was disheartened when he visited his grandfather's grave on Veterans Day 2 years ago. No flags or flowers on any of the veterans' headstones. So Preston Sharp of Reading decided to take action. Set a goal for all the veterans' headstones at McDonald's Chapel in Reading Memorial Park. Each would be recognized with a flag and a flower. Fox News says he created a GoFundMe page for help. Recently, he organized the placement of more than 17,500 flags and flowers at cemeteries across Northern California, raised $30,000 so far. For his efforts, he's received community awards and recognition from military groups throughout the state. 12 years old. Nice work, my man. For Jennifer Koshenka, I'm Gordon Deal. That'll do it for this weekend.